take you back to Hiroshima, Japan. That is the U.S. President Joe Biden holding a news conference after attending the G7 summit. Let's listen in.
With all four congressional leaders, and we agreed the only way to move forward was in a bipartisan agreement. And I've done my part. We put forward a proposal to cut spending by more than $1 trillion. And on top of the nearly $3 trillion in deficit reduction that I previously proposed through the combination of spending cuts and new revenues. Now it's time for the other side to move from their extreme positions, because much of what they've already proposed is simply, quite frankly, unacceptable. And so let me be clear. I'm not going to agree to a deal that protects, for example, $30 billion tax break for the oil industry, which made $200 billion last year. They don't need an incentive of another $30 billion, while putting health care of 21 million Americans at risk by going after Medicaid. I'm not going to agree to a deal that protects $200 billion in excess payments for pharmaceutical industries and refusing to count that, while cutting over 100,000 school teachers and assistance jobs, 30,000 law enforcement officers, jobs cut across the entire United States of America. I'm not going to agree to a deal that protects wealthy tax cheats and crypto traders while putting food assistance at risk for nearly 1 million Americans. It's time for Republicans to accept that there is no bipartisan deal to be made solely on their partisan terms. They have to move as well. All four congressional leaders agree with me that default is not an option. And I expect each of these leaders to live up to that commitment. America has never defaulted on our debt, and it never will. The Speaker and I will be talking later on the plane as we head back, because it's what, 5 or 6, 7 o'clock in the morning there, and our teams are going to continue working. Now, we've had a packed few days here in Hiroshima, and I think with very productive and important meetings at the G7 summit. We also held the Quad meeting here in Hiroshima rather than Australia, and important bilateral discussions with Prime Minister Kishida of Japan, Prime Minister Albanese of Australia, and President Zelensky of Ukraine, as well as the Prime Minister of India. This is my third trip to the Indo-Pacific as president, and I look forward to rescheduling my stops in Papua New Guinea and Australia later. I've spoken with the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, and Secretary Blinken is traveling there to meet with the Pacific Island partners at that moment. And I'm also going to be hosting, and I've spoken with the Prime Minister, hosting the leaders of the Pacific Island Forum in Washington this fall, because I've been unable to make it to Papua New Guinea. And Prime Minister Albanese, we're going to have a state visit later this year. And I also want to thank President Kishida for his outstanding, outstanding leadership of the G7 this year, as well as Mrs. Kishida and the entire Japanese government for the hospitality they've shown to Jill, myself, and our whole team. Being in this city and visiting the memorial on Friday was a powerful reminder of the devastating reality of nuclear war and our shared responsibility to never cease our efforts to build for peace. And together with the leaders of the G7, we have reiterated our commitment to continue to work toward a world free from the threat of nuclear weapons. Over the past few days have showcased the unity of purpose among the G7. It's a very different organization than it was 5, 7, 10 years ago, because we're addressing the challenges that matter most to the world. We're united in our efforts to strengthen global health security. And yesterday I announced that the United States plans to contribute another $250 million to the pandemic fund at the World Bank, to make sure the world is better prepared to prevent, detect, and respond to future pandemics. We're united in our commitment to climate action and accelerating the transition to a global clean energy economy by investing in the industries of the future. We're united in our push to build a more resilient and inclusive global economy that can better withstand the kinds of shocks that we've experienced over the last few years, including by building a more secure and more diversified supply chain. through the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, which we launched last year at the G7 summit in Germany, we've addressed the infrastructure needs that are holding back too many low and moderate income countries, particularly in the global south. The United States has already mobilized more than $30 billion in PGII projects around the globe, a significant step toward our collective pledge of the G7 to mobilize $600 billion in investment by 2027. And we resolved to reform the multilateral development banks to give them more flexibility and better able to fight poverty by helping respond to global challenges. Now, we're also united in our approach to the People's Republic of China. And the joint statement released yesterday outlines the shared principles we've all agreed to at the G7 and beyond dealing with China. We're not looking to decouple from China. We're looking to de-risk and diversify our relationship with China. That means taking steps to diversify our supply chains, and we're not dependent on any one country for necessary product. It means resisting economic coercion together and countering harmful practices that hurt our workers. It means protecting a narrow set of advanced technologies critical for our national security. And those elements are all agreed on by the G7. Finally, joined here in Hiroshima by President Zelensky, and the G7 reaffirmed our shared and unwavering, let me say it again, our shared and unwavering commitment to stand with the brave people of Ukraine as they defend themselves against Russia's brutal war of aggression and the war crimes being committed. Together with our partner countries, we reiterated the need for a just peace that respects Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, both core principles of the UN Charter. Russia started this war, and Russia could end it today by withdrawing its troops from Ukraine, internationally recognized borders, and ceasing its assault. Until then, Ukraine's ability to defend itself is essential to being able to end this war permanently and through diplomacy. You know, and this morning, I once more shared and assured President Zelensky, together with all G7 members and our allies and partners around the world, that we will not waver. Putin will not break our resolve as he thought he could 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago. We're going to continue to provide economic, humanitarian, and security assistance to Ukraine so it can stand strong as long as it needs it. And today, the United States announced our latest tranche of artillery, ammunition, anti-tank weapons, and bridging equipment to help Ukraine succeed in the battlefield. You know, in my private meeting with President Zelensky after the G7 meeting, and with his staff, I told him the United States, together with our allies and partners, is going to begin training Ukrainian pilots in fourth-generation fighter aircraft, including F-16s, to strengthen Ukraine's Air Force as part of a long-term commitment to Ukraine's ability to defend itself. We provided the last year all that they needed to deal with what they were dealing with at the moment. And that's when now we're moving in the direction of putting them in a position to be able to be defend themselves in ways beyond what they've had to deal with so far. The past few days have once more underscored how important America's global leadership is. Presumptuous thing for American president to say, but I think you'll find if you ask any of our colleagues, it's true. The security and prosperity of the American people are substantially increased by working in concert with our closest allies and partners to build a future of greater economic strength and resilience, in a world that is more peaceful and stable. And on many of these issues that matter to the American people, accelerating our clean energy transition, preventing another pandemic, dealing with China, standing up for Ukraine, the meetings I've had with my fellow G7 leaders have left us more united, more resolved, and more determined to set up for the greater progress in the months ahead. And this has been an extremely significant and important summit. With that, I'm going to take some questions. And Trevor of Reuters.
You spoke a moment ago about what you won't do in terms of your negotiations with Republicans, but I'm interested in what you've signaled you already might do. In particular, by conceding in these negotiations to some form of a cap or freezing spending. Are you concerned that Mr. McCarthy has already forced you into accepting a policy position that could tip this economy into a recession?
No, I don't believe that's the case at all. As a matter of fact, I think that we can reach an agreement. As I've told you, and you may be aware, you've seen it, we have provided for a proposal that would cut $1 trillion off the baseline spent from the year before by just agreeing to deal with what was initially offered. And secondly, we're in a situation where let me put it this way. If you all were doing your budget at home and you said, okay, we have to make some cuts, would you only look at the spending? Would you also look at your income, what was coming in the door, to determine what you could afford? And so part of what I've been arguing from the beginning is a need to consider the tax structure as well as cutting spending. I'm willing to cut spending, and I propose cuts in spending of over $1 trillion. But I believe we have to also look at the tax revenues. The idea that my Republican colleagues want to continue the $2 trillion tax cut that had profound negative impacts on the economy from the Trump administration, the fact that we've provided for the number, we got a lot of input from serious economists and former administration officials in both parties, that we need more people who are qualified to be able to look at the tax returns of the 1,000 billionaires in America. Very complicated stuff. It's estimated that if we had the appropriate number of tax personnel, that we would generate somewhere between $200 billion and $400 billion in tax revenue. And there's a lot of other, for example, the idea that we're, in terms of taxes, that they refuse to. For example, I was able to balance the budget and pass everything from the global warming bill. Anyway, I was able to cut by $1.7 billion in the first 2 years the deficit that we were accumulating. And because I was able to say to it that the 55 corporations in America that made $400 billion, that they pay zero in tax, zero. And so we said, you got to pay a minimum of 15% taxes. What a horrible thing. You're paying more than 15% in taxes, every one of you out there. And so guess what? We not only balanced the budget, we were able to reduce the deficit by $1.7 billion. And so there's a lot of things that they refuse to look at in terms of tax generation, as well as what kind of people we're going to increase taxes for. And like I said, we're now down to, we went from roughly 740 billionaires to about 1,000 billionaires in America. They're paying an average tax rate of 8%. Raise your hand if you want to pay 8% only. I think you'd all be ready to do that. So my point is that there's a lot of things that they refuse to entertain, and they just said revenue is off the table. Well, revenue is not off the table. And so that's what we continue to have a significant disagreement on the revenue side.
But you don't think the spending cuts themselves will cause a recession?
I know they won't. I know they won't. Matter of fact, the fact that we were able to cut government spending by $1.7 trillion, that didn't cause a recession, that caused growth. Look, we have the lowest unemployment rate in over 50 years. We've created 7 million new jobs, including 800,000 manufacturing jobs. We have moved in a direction where we're rebuilding and reconstructing America through the Infrastructure Act. Look, here's the other thing. My guess is I'll get a question about, well, wait a minute, the American people aren't satisfied. Well, guess what? As I told you all before, most of this, what we passed, doesn't kick in. It only kicks in over time. And so the fact is, for example, that if you're in a situation where you were, I'll give you the one example that I've used, everybody understands the easiest, is insulin. Well, I decided that we were going to be in a position where we were not going to continue to pay the highest drug prices in the world. And that's what we do, by the way. Same manufacturer of a drug in the United States, selling it here in Japan, selling it in Tokyo, or selling it in Berlin, or selling it around the world, they pay a lot less than we pay at home. So we said a simple proposition. Let's take a look at how much it costs to make the product. And I'm not going to ask you to show of hands like I do in a town meeting, but if I usually ask how many people know somebody who has type 1 or type 2 diabetes, and almost at least half the audience raises their hand. Well, they were paying somewhere between $400 and $700 a month for their insulin that they badly need to stay healthy and alive. Well, guess what? It costs $10, T-E-N, $10 to make. To package, total amount, you could argue maybe as much as $13. Well, guess what? Now they can't charge more for Medicare, can't, because Medicare is paying, taking American tax dollars and paying for the elderly's health care needs. You can't charge more than $35 for that drug. That saves $160 billion. Hear it? $160 billion less will be paid out by the American taxpayer to help the elderly people on Medicare with a problem. Well, a lot of this is just kicking in. We're in a situation where next year, for the drug costs, no senior will have to pay total cost of all the drugs, from expensive cancer drugs to whatever drug they're taking, will not have to pay more than $3,500 a year. The following year, we've already passed this is a law now. The following year, they won't have to pay more than $2,000. That saves another $200 billion that we're paying out. But the other team won't count this. Even though it's a law, we passed it, they won't count that as reducing the debt. So there's a lot of those kinds of disagreements we have. And my guess is that I'm going to be talking to the Speaker of the House on the way back on the plane, because it'll be morning time over at home. And I'm going to be in that plane in about an hour or so. And my guess is he's going to want to deal directly with me and making sure we're all on the same page. But that's probably more than you wanted to know. How about Masero, NHK?
Hey, good evening, Mr. President. The Chinese military is more active at this time in the Taiwan Strait, with expectations this might increase leading up to Taiwan's presidential election next January. Despite some diplomatic communication recently between the U.S. and China, the military hotline is not working. Under this circumstance, how will you manage the diplomatic, relationship with China? And how will you strengthen the U.S. alliance with Japan and ROK in order to counter China? Thank you.
Well, number one, you're right. We should have an open hotline. At the Bali conference, that's what the President Xi and I agreed we were going to do and meet on. And then this silly balloon that was carrying two freight cars worth of spying equipment was flying over the United States, and it got shot down, and everything changed in terms of talking to one another. I think you're going to see that begin to thaw very shortly. But in the meantime, what's happened is, I think it's fair to say, for those of you who have dealt with the Japanese government and reported from here for a long time, the situation in terms of our relations with Japan have never, ever, ever in American history been stronger. Never. Never. And we started this relationship when I came to see, some of you were with me on my first trip here, when I came to see President Kishida's predecessor, and made the case that what was happening in Europe, the world's getting smaller. What's happening in Europe and the invasion of Ukraine affects everyone, including people here in the Pacific Basin. And so we've ended up where you have Japan stepping up in a way that's of real consequence in terms of your defense budget, number one, and a beginning of a rapprochement with South Korea. I've spoken at length with President Moon of South Korea. He came to Washington of late. He's agreed, we're all of the same agreement, that in fact, we are not going to, we're maintaining, we all agree we're going to maintain the one China policy, which says everybody kind of forgets. Now, I mean, you all know, but the public kind of forgets that it says that neither country, China or Taiwan, neither territory can independently declare what they're going to do, period. There has to be a mutually agreed to outcome. And so we're sticking by that. We're not going to tell China what they can do. We made it clear that we don't expect Taiwan to independently declare independence either. But in the meantime, we're going to continue to put Taiwan in a position that they can defend themselves. And there is clear understanding among most of our allies that, in fact, if China were to act unilaterally, there would be a response. There would be a response. So I don't think there's anything inevitable about the notion that there's going to be this conflict between the United States and the West and or Japan and Korea and the Quad. And if you take a look at what's happened, we are more secure with all the talk about China's building its military. It is building its military. And that's why I've made it clear that I am not going to prepare, I'm not prepared to trade certain items with China. And when I was asked by President Xi why, I said, because you're using them to build nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, and I'm not going to do it. And we've now got commitment from all of our allies. They're not going to either provide that kind of material that allows them to do that. But that's not a hostile act. That's an act that says we're going to make sure that we do everything we can to maintain the status quo ante. And what's going on now is look at the meeting we had here today and yesterday of the Quad. I bet you, I would, maybe some of you thought it, but I doubt many people in this audience or any other audience would have said that 2 years after being elected, I'd be able to convince India, Australia, Japan, and the United States to form an organization called the Quad to maintain stability in the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea. Well, when asked by the Prime Minister, President Xi, why we're doing that, I said, simple. We have an international organizations have agreed upon what constitutes open airspace and sea space. And we're not going to allow that to be unilaterally altered, period. We're not changing any rules. We're just making sure that we unite democracies in the conviction that the Pacific Basin remains what it was before, open and clear. So I guess what I'm saying is, I don't guess what I'm saying. What I'm trying to say is I think we're more united than we've ever been in the Pacific in terms of maintaining stability and maintaining a sense of security. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but I hope it does. If it doesn't, do you want to follow up with any portion of that question? Well,
you're watching Al Jazeera. That's the U.S. President Joe Biden. He's speaking in Hiroshima in Japan on the sidelines of the G7 summit, speaking to reporters there. What he said is that the meetings of the G7 have been productive. This, of course, coming after he had met with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the sidelines of the summit, Zelensky also being in attendance. And Biden said that the G7 countries share an unwavering commitment to stand with the people of Ukraine. He also pointed fingers at Russia, saying that Russia started this war and Russia can end it, and that Putin will not break, quote, our resolve when it comes to Ukraine. Let's bring in Rob McBride. He was listening in to that press conference, joining us as well from Hiroshima in Japan. So, Rob, I mean, a large part of that press conference was spent addressing sort of U.S. domestic issues by the President Biden. But when it came to the G7 meetings and Ukraine, which has dominated the agenda there, he was keen to show that all members are united when it comes to their support and commitment. What do you think the takeaway message was?
Well, he was telling the press there that the G7 has never been more united as it is at the moment. You're right that a lot of it was taken up with domestic politics. He's traveling, well, obviously, with the White House press corps. That is their concern. You also get a sense that that is Joe Biden's concern at the moment. You remember, he is cutting short his visit to Asia Pacific. He was due to go down to Australia and to Papua New Guinea. Instead of that, as he says there, he'll be on a plane in an hour or so. And as soon as they start waking up in Washington, he will be on the phone dealing with this debt crisis back in the United States. When it comes to the Ukraine, though, he mentioned how the unwavering support that Volodymyr Zelensky has been shown, saying that it was that Russia that started it, that Russia must end it, and also reminding that any kind of peace deal must respect respect the sovereignty of a country, the integrity of a country. That seems to be a sideways swipe at China, because their peace plan controversially calls for a ceasefire, but without Russia first giving up any of its territory. And then finally, just in hard dollar terms, he talked about the latest tranche of materiel that's going to be sent to Ukraine, about the ammunition, and also crucially about the training of F-16 pilots. The United States has given permission finally for Ukraine to get F-16 planes from some other European countries, other NATO allies, not necessarily the US, but did talk about the giving permission and also being involved in the training. And then also when it comes to Ukraine, talking about the importance of US leadership, he says, in having this coalition and bringing countries together to challenge Russia and its invasion of Ukraine.
Okay, Rob, thank you so much. That's our Rob McBride joining us from Hiroshima in Japan. We'll continue this conversation with Vyacheslav Matuzov, who's a former Russian diplomat. He's joining us from Moscow via Skype for reaction. Thanks for joining us on Al Jazeera, first of all. So what's your reaction to what the U.S. President Joe Biden has just said at the press conference, really showing that there's a whole lot of diplomatic backing for Ukraine by all G7 members? And also, I'm sure you're aware, earlier on, he had unveiled a $375 million military aid package to Ukraine. How will Moscow be looking at this?
It is not for the first time we are hearing a united position of not only G7, but all Western world united under chairmanship of the United States. They are supporting Ukraine army, Ukraine administration very strongly. It is not any new news for Russia, I think. The military assistance, a military equipment that was sent to Ukraine army, they are not respond to any peaceful efforts were made by some European countries, Asian countries, and Arabian even countries too. They were trying to play role of some countries to bring peace in the to the Ukrainian soil.
Right.
But now we see that there is no efforts for the West countries, for the United States, to bring this situation in Ukraine from military confrontation to peaceful negotiations. They are insisting on destroying Russian forces.
But what Joe Biden said just a moment ago, in fact, he said that Russia started this war and Russia can end it by withdrawing its troops from Ukraine.
First of all, Russia sent their troops after very strong efforts to bring relations between the United States and Russia on equal base, to agree on mutual agreement for security, in national security, because it was very strange to listen today that Russia began the war when in December 1991 Russia suggested to the United States administration, to Mr. Biden, to agree with Russia to sign an agreement for mutual assurance of independence and security measures, not to threaten Russia, not spreading NATO to the Russian borders.
Okay, let me just jump in there and take us back to what's happened at the G7, because we also saw that the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was in attendance. And not only did he get to meet members of the G7, but in fact, he met non-member countries. He had the opportunity to meet with the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, for one, who's kind of been on the sidelines and hasn't really taken a side when it comes to Ukraine or Russia. Is that going to bother the Kremlin?
Well, you know, Mr. Modi, who is presented on G7 in Hiroshima, of course, but we remember that Russia has very strong relations in economical ties with India. This time, in spite of the fact that the United States made all efforts to prohibit trade relations between India and Russia, India doesn't obey American orders. That's why India support also the tendency, the ideas in the framework of BRICS country. BRICS country, India is one of the main participants, main members of this organization.
Right.
So I can say that there is no united opinion of all countries to what is going on the European continent.
Okay,
we'll have to leave
it there. We thank you so much. My apologies, but we'll have to cross back to Hiroshima and listen in to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who's holding a news conference right now after attending the G7 summit. Let's listen in.
Дуже дякую.
Thank you so much for the important words of support. Thank you so much.
Шановні присутні,
dear presentees, dear
японські народи,
Japanese people, everyone in the world who values peace. I come here from a country where war could have left only a shadow on the stones of history. But our heroic people are turning history around so that we can make war itself become a shadow. I believe that war has no place in the world. Humanity has come a very long way and lost many lives in bloody confrontations. Death fell from the skies. Death came from the sea. Radiation brought death. People brought death to each other. Some say that human history cannot be imagined without the war. We say that the history of mankind should be without war. Ukraine is in the midst of a war of destruction. Invaders have come to our land, and they want not only to conquer us, Ukrainians, but Russia is lying to the world that there are no Ukrainians. If we were not so brave, the Russian genocide against us could have succeeded. The shadow would be of Ukraine and from the whole nation, just a shadow. But Ukrainians are infinitely brave, infinitely freedom-loving, and we will live freely. Although the enemy is using non-nuclear weapons, the ruins of our cities, which have been burned to the ground by Russian bombs and artillery, are similar to what I've just seen here, which was an honor for me to be in this Museum of Peace. Thank you so much that you gave me such an opportunity. Your people, what I have seen and what your people have unfortunately seen in their history. Instead of the normal life of thousands and thousands of families, only ashes remain. Instead of cities, there is a scorched wasteland. Instead of houses, only rubble. And now Hiroshima is a rebuilt city. And we dream of rebuilding all our cities that are now in ruins, and every village where not a single house is left intact after Russian strikes. We dream of returning our territories, just as we have regained our northern territories, which were occupied by Russia. We must regain our eastern and southern territories of Ukraine. We dream of returning our people who are now in Russian captivity. These are prisoners of war and civilians, deported adults, and also abducted children. We dream of winning. We dream of peace after our victory. But for this to happen, not only this aggressor has to lose, the ambition of the war itself has to lose. And this is what is important for everyone in the world. I'm here in Hiroshima so that the world can hear the Ukrainian call for unity from here. Russia has trampled on everything that is civilized. It has been occupying our largest nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, for over a year now. Russia is the only terrorist state in the world that has fired tanks at a nuclear power plant. No one else has ever used a nuclear power plant as a training ground for weapons and shells. Russia is hiding behind a nuclear power plant to fire rocket artillery at our cities. If anyone in the world is still able to ignore Russia's other war crimes, its crime against humanity should definitely prompt action by everyone. This is from us, Ukraine, which had to endure the radiation disaster of Chernobyl in 1986. Until
now, that's the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky also speaking at Hiroshima, Japan, on the final day of that G7 summit. This, of course, after he had met with the President Joe Biden, and he met with other world leaders attending the G7 summit. And earlier we heard from the U.S. President, who had announced that the U.S. is unveiling a $375 million military aid package for Ukraine.